This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you in part by The Strenuous Life. The Strenuous Life is an online platform that we created to help you put into action all the things we've been talking about, writing about on AOM for the past 12 years. We've done that in a few ways. First, we got 50 different badges based around 50 different skills. We've got weekly challenges that are going to put you outside of your comfort zone and accountability for your physical fitness, doing a good deed, thinking outside of yourself, as well as you'll be a part of a membership of like-minded individuals who are all pushing themselves to become better and more useful. Head over to strenuouslife.co. Find out more information, what's involved, what you get, and make sure you get your email on our waiting list so you'll be one of the first to know when enrollment opens up. StrenuousLife.co. Hope to see you there. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Well, modern technology has provided us with an unprecedented amount of comfort. For example, with just a turn of a dial, we can ensure that our homes are always set at a perpetual 71 degrees, even if it's blazing hot or frigidly cold outside. But what if our quest for technology-enabled comfort has actually made us physically and mentally weaker and sicker? What if our bodies actually need discomfort to truly thrive and flourish? My guest today explores that idea firsthand in his book, What Doesn't Kill Us, How Freezing Water, Extreme Altitude, and Environmental Conditioning Will Renew Our Lost Evolutionary Strength. His name is Scott Carney. He's an anthropologist and a writer. And in his latest book, he investigates the sometimes crazy sounding claims of a Dutch daredevil and prophet of intentional stress exposure named Wim Hof. For years, Scott followed Wim's method of physical vitality that consists of daily hyperventilation, breathing exercises, and cold exposure to see what it would do to his physiology. And the results truly astonished him. Along the way, he interviews scientists, researchers, and athletes who are at the forefront of exploring why embracing environmental discomfort is the missing key to our overall health. On today's show, Scott and I discuss Wim Hof and his claims, the health benefits of exposing ourselves to the cold, and how hyperventilating may help you do more push-ups than you ever thought possible. If you enjoyed our content on the health benefits of cold showers, you're going to love this podcast. After the show's over, check out the show notes at aom.is/coldexposure. Scott Carney, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much.
All right. So you wrote a book called What Doesn't Kill Us, How Freezing Water, Extreme Altitude, and Environmental Conditioning Will Renew Our Lost Evolutionary Strength. And it follows you as you follow the practices and methodologies of a guy named Wim Hof. We'll get to Wim here in a minute because he's an interesting guy. But let's start with the premise of this book. You start off arguing in the book that modern life is making us weaker and sicker. How so?
Well, you know, if you think about where our species came from, you know, Homo sapiens sapien, we are about 200,000 years old. That's when we evolved from our previous ancestor, which was, you know, pretty similar to us. And in that time, we endured all the variations that nature could throw at us. Even in the equatorial regions of Africa, you know, the temperature swing between night and day could be 50 degrees. And then we left Africa. We went through, crossed the Alps with just a whisper of modern technology. We went through Asia, made it to Australia and the New World. And all of this was with nothing to really help us, you know, some fur skins, some sailboats, some sort of basic stuff. And to do it, we had to rely on our amazing innate biology to resist the elements, to resist these variations. If you went back in time, it would be a terrible idea to challenge one of your ancestors to an arm wrestling match or a foot race. They would just crush you. And one of the reasons for this is that now we live in this cocoon of technological comfort where our need for that sort of like that, you know, we can call homeostasis, this place where the environment meets every biological need has made our bodies not have to do any work. And because of that, we don't experience the natural variations that our biology developed in. We live in a perpetual summer of 72 degrees, and it doesn't matter what the outdoor temperature is like. You know, we have antiseptic environments where, you know, we've scrubbed out the bacteria and the things that attack us. And this, you know, makes the underlying biology that we have that wants to resist, that where change was constant, it makes that biology underutilized. In some cases, it turns inwards and attacks itself, leading to autoimmune illnesses. But also, we're just not able to, you know, we look outside at a snowstorm and we consider that extreme weather and we're like, hell no, I don't want to go out there. But our species can do that. And so what this process of the book was doing was exposing myself to some extreme temperatures and some extreme environments and unlocking that hidden biology that every one of us has inside.
Right. And besides the autoimmune diseases, I mean, what are some of the other diseases of civilization that have come from constant comfort?
Oh my God, there's so many. There's osteoporosis is one, diabetes, obesity, poor sleep cycles because of the constant electric lighting that we have. My favorite and one that I come back to in the book all the time is just since the 1990s. Do you remember that time period? I don't know how old you are. You probably remember the 90s, right?
I'm 34. Yeah, 34.
Okay, fantastic. Do you remember that when you moved to a new city and you were like, hey, this is a cool place. I want to go explore and find my way across town. You had to take out this ancient piece of technology, which had like a picture of the city on it and the streets and their names on the streets. And you had to navigate your way across the city by using this map. I think that's how you pronounce it. I haven't seen one in a while. By using that map, you sort of just learned innately how to navigate the city. Nowadays, when I move to a new place, I have a GPS and I rely on it for every turn as I go through. And I've lost this innate ability that humans have to tell direction. And that's just happened in our lifetime.
Yeah, it's nuts. And you also talk about some of the other changes thanks to technology. I mean, a lot of these diseases of civilization have come with technology. It's not just, you know, digital technology, but like even like rudimentary technology, like cooking with fire, that made our jaws weaker, right?
Yeah. Well, fire is a really interesting case because it's an old technology, right? That goes possibly all the way back to Homo erectus, which is our ancestor's ancestor's ancestor. And what happened when we invented fire was that we could, instead of, you know, this sort of chimp-like primate, our ancestor, which would have to chew cellulose and sort of, vegetables and things. You'd have to chew a hell of a lot to get out the nutrition. And they had really big guts because of that, because you just had to have more digestive tract. Your jaws were like the super powerful. Think of a chimp's jaws. Like that's some serious tooth action. As we invented fire, what that did is it outsourced the ability of our bodies to essentially, you digest food outside your body, and by cooking something, you're able. It becomes essentially more nutritious, and you have to chew it less. So our over time, fire made our jaws smaller, made our gut smaller. And that led us to be able to walk around upright in sort of a convoluted evolutionary path for the way we search for food. It made us. It also gave us more time to, instead of just chewing all the time, right? We actually had time to use our brains to do other things. So fire is one of these technologies that evolved slowly with us. And actually we had it and it changed our physiology. We are impossible to separate from fire. Like our bodies could not exist without fire. But what I'm looking at in the book is more these modern technologies like heating and all of these conveniences that we have now, where our bodies haven't had a chance to adapt slowly like they did to fire. It's like it was just dropped on us. And if we've been around for 200,000 years, that we're talking 150 years. That's like a blink of an evolutionary eye. And that stuff, our body just hasn't caught up to the new environment that we inhabit, and that is doing crazy things to us.
Right. So the mismatch is causing these problems.
Exactly.
Okay. So let's talk about Wim Hof. So I've heard of Wim Hof. He seems like possibly a madman, crazy guy, charlatan, but he's doing some crazy things to counter these diseases of civilization, where he's purposely exposing himself to extreme cold, extreme conditions, and he's surviving. We'll talk about, I mean, can you talk about some of the crazy things that he has done that baffle people that he's able to do this?
Yeah, he holds all sorts of crazy records for mostly having to do with his body being extreme cold things. And I actually first heard about him when I was a foreign correspondent for Wired magazine in India. And there was a little small snippet in the paper of this guy who was climbing Mount Everest in just a pair of shorts. So bare chest climbing up Mount Everest. And he made it up three quarters of the way. And at the time I was like, this guy is insane. And not only insane, he's disrespectful to the power of nature. He's run barefoot marathons in the Arctic across snow. He's run marathons through the Kalahari Desert. With no water. He holds the record for swimming underneath sea ice in distance. I mean, he has done these things which really are superhuman. And he's stayed in an ice bath for, I believe, 90 minutes, and his body temperature while they were testing him actually rose while he was in the bath. And usually, a person who's not trained and just sort of dunked into this ice might die from anywhere between 15 and 45 minutes. So he does things that are superhuman. And you are right to say he sounds like a madman, because he's absolutely a madman, because only a madman would do this. But he's also a prophet, because he's showing that what the human body is able to do if conditioned consciously and correctly into these environments. So I when I first heard of him, I'm an investigative journalist, I'm an anthropologist, and I had written several books and articles at that point about the dangers of intensive meditation, and in particular, the types of spiritual practices that offer you superpowers. In 2005, I was leading an abroad program in northern India. I was an anthropologist getting my PhD at the time. And one of my students, the best, the brightest, the smartest student in the program, at the end of the silent meditation retreat, as we're contemplating enlightenment, contemplating nirvana, she climbs up to the roof of the retreat center and jumps to her death, committing suicide on the last day of the retreat. And, as the person who was in charge of her, of these students, I had to read her journal, and I was involved with the police investigation, and it was a horrible thing. But in her journal, the last words in it were, "I am a bodhisattva," which means I am enlightened, that I am going to be essentially an angel, and all I need to do is leave my body to attain that state. And this is the cautionary experience that led me down to write another book about intensive meditation, where people literally get so caught up in this idea of spiritual transcendence and becoming supernatural almost, that they lose touch with reality and a lot of people die. And it's a story that's not really talked about very much. So with all of this in mind, when I hear about Wim Hof, and this is in 2011, 2012, I am certain that he is one of these sort of guru charlatans who wants to tell people that he can give them superpowers, take all their money as he does it, and then potentially get people killed. And I wanted to get in front of that and show people that the attainment of superpowers is not a great idea.
Yeah, but he is claiming that some superpowers, like he claims that with meditation and breathing and exposure, like you can on demand increase your metabolism so you warm yourself up, or on demand you can increase your immunity system so you can fight diseases. So he is making those claims. So I mean,
damn right. And I think I was absolutely right to go out there and try to debunk this guy, because they are huge, and they are things that you should be absolutely skeptical of. But as an anthropologist, as an investigative journalist who has a certain set of ethics that I abide by, when I went out to see him on a commission that eventually ran in Playboy magazine, my intention was to debunk him, but by doing it through his method, by saying, look, I'm going to learn your method and I'm going to watch it fall apart. I'm going to watch these students be mindless followers of your method and you basically taking advantage of them. And then I'm going to see you put us into a dangerous situation that, then I'll be able to tell the tragic story of Wim Hof. But it turns out that when I did the method, that when I actually did his breathing method and his environmental exposure routines, that things in my own physiology started changing very rapidly. Now, I was living in Los Angeles at the time. So we're talking perpetual summer there. And I fly to Poland in the middle of the winter that stopped Napoleon's army. You know, it's the winter that ground Hitler's blitzkrieg to a halt. And within a couple days, I'm standing outside in the middle of this just frigid cold in nothing but shorts with my bare feet in the snow, and I'm burning up. And I can stay out in the snow for an hour like this. You know, we do these things like I sit on the banks of a river and all the snow melts around me because my body is running so hot. And then I climb up a mountain in Poland. It's actually a ski slope called Snezka. And we spend about 8 hours on this mountain. It's about 2 degrees Fahrenheit outside. And I make it to the top and I'm hot the entire way. I'm sweating and I'm just in, you know, shorts and boots. So, I mean, it's an amazing, it was eye opening, and it happened so rapidly that I was like, there was nothing I could do but say that Hof is onto something. Now, he may make some grandiose claims that surpass this shock and awe at that point, but it was enough for me to realize that I had to examine this guy on fair terms and really delve deeply into the ideas that he's putting forward, that we can unlock hidden human potential. And these aren't superpowers. These are human powers that we all have. And, you know, and I think that's the crux of it, right? We don't have superpowers. We have just normal human abilities that we have suppressed.
So what does his method look like? So part of it is just getting exposed to the cold. What else is involved?
So there's two basic parts of the method. And you can learn the Wim Hof method in like 15 or 20 minutes. Like, it's not very, very difficult because it involves putting yourself in situations where the environment creates a predictable biological response. So in the cold, one of the things would be, the first thing that happens when you jump into the snow, you know, is you tense up, or you're taking a cold shower, you tense up. And then eventually you'll start shivering. And this is just your body trying to fight that stimulus. And what Wim teaches is that you get into that situation, and instead of tensing up, you relax. You just let that cold sort of in, and by suppressing that tensing moment and suppressing the shiver, you actually are having a significant impact on your sympathetic nervous system. And these are your fight or flight responses. And by modulating that, you actually start gaining control over how your sympathetic nervous system works. And it's, you know, and because our bodies have evolved to adapt quickly, you actually get this control super fast. It doesn't take very long to accumulate that. And so, you know, when you're standing you jump into ice water or something, you just don't shiver. You just suppress that, and your body figures out a different way to heat itself up. At first, it does it sort of weakly, but over time, it's able to sort of really ramp up the engine and keep you warm in those environments. The other part of the method is a breathing method where you don't need to do it at the same time. You don't do this in the cold water or something. You do this, you know, it could be separated by hours in the day. It's fine. Where you hyperventilate, which are not like panicky hyperventilations, but deep, rapid breaths. It would sound something like this. And you do about 30 of those, right? And then at the end of that, you let all of the air out of your lungs, and then you hold your breath for as long as you can. Usually I'll do about a minute at first, and then you do another hyperventilation round, and then you hold your breath again. And then all of a sudden, instead of just a minute of holding my breath, I can hold it for 2 minutes. Do another round that I'm holding it for 3 minutes. And it's really a very fast increase. And what you're trying to do is suppress this response and modulate this response, this need for gasping. And once you get that, that's another parasympathetic response. And so you're gaining control of both sides of this autonomic nervous system by doing these two sorts of exercises. And at the end of that, then you what you do is you do a third round of hyperventilation, and then you let all the air out of your lungs. You just start doing push-ups. Just immediately, just go into doing, you know, your normal push-up routine of whatever you do. And when I first had started this, doing this practice, I could do about 20 push-ups. You know, I'm not an athlete. I'm just a dude, a journalist. You know, I'm a writer. I could do 20 push-ups. But when I did this breathing method at Wim's house, I could do 40, and I wasn't breathing, and I had no air in my lungs. It was amazing. And now I do it every morning. I do 50 push-ups breathless. The most I've ever hit was 80. And it's, you know, it's just a really surprising thing. And maybe that's the aha moment where I decided that Wim was really onto something, because you don't just double the amount of exercises you can do with a breathing method. That's just not how I thought the world worked.
Well, and so you, besides following Wim, you actually go and talk to scientists who have been researching some of the things that Wim's been doing. So, like with the breathing thing, why is it that you're able to do more push-ups by doing this hyperventilating exercise and holding your breath? What's going on there?
Well, so the first thing that's happening is you're blowing off carbon dioxide from your lungs, and so the way your body detects that it needs to breathe air, like it's running out of breath, it detects the buildup of CO2. It can't actually detect oxygen. And that's just the way the body's biology works. So when you hyperventilate, you blow off all of that CO2. And then you're moving that gas point later, because then as you're holding your breath, that respiration has to basically fill up your lungs again with CO2, or the bloodstream has to accumulate CO2. And that's like, okay, great, we got CO2 and we need to breathe. So you're just tricking your body's normal respiratory method by blowing off all that CO2. And pushing yourself into a physical place where you can do more push-ups. And the reason why this is interesting, right, rather than it's just a hack that's okay, you just tricked your body, is that you still did the push-ups, right? Your body actually had that ability to do this, and its warning signals were actually far too conservative. Like, your body has this sort of, you know, if we the world we grew up in, right, which is sort of homeostatic, which is comfortable, we set off our alarm bells for where we're reaching our limits super duper early. And if you start doing these things where you're pushing yourself in this hypoxic or sort of low oxygen environment, all of a sudden your body starts to learn that it actually has more ability and will sort of seed a little bit more control into your system. Into your mind.
Yeah. So what's the benefit of that? I mean, like, besides doing more push-ups, like, how else does that translate into performance in other areas?
So one, and there's lots of ways that this happens. I mean, it increases your ability to rest, to breathe in general, and which puts more oxygen in your bloodstream, gives you more available energy. But I think the most interesting way that I've seen people use it is when I met a guy named Brian McKenzie and this legendary surfer, Laird Hamilton, who both get sort of a chapter in the book. And what they're doing, Brian McKenzie is one of the founders of high intensity interval training, or HIIT workouts. And the idea between HIIT workouts is that if you train at the absolute maximum exertion, athletes would call the VO2 max, then or if you're like, if you're trying to train for a marathon, instead of logging more and more miles every week, you just do these sprints, but at your absolute highest level, then you actually are pushing your body much better and much more efficiently to run marathons elsewhere. So shorter workouts, shorter high intensity workouts are more efficient. Now, when that mixes with the Wim Hof method, if you're now prepping yourself to push past what your limits are, so like instead of going at 100%, if you can trick your body into like 104% or 107%, then your high intensity interval workouts are even more power packed, and you get that much more benefit for these longer endurance races. And it's awesome. I mean, you see these just top tier athletes doing this method now.
And this only works for endurance. Like, you wouldn't be able to do this and then pull a deadlift ER, right?
No, actually, I think, that's a good question. Like, how does it affect strength? This is probably a little bit outside of my knowledge, Bill, because I'm not a big weightlifter. But I would say that if you can suddenly do more reps than you could usually do in training, right, then wouldn't that make you a stronger person in general? Right. If all of a sudden I could do 20 pushups, right? I was usually doing 20 pushups, and now I can do 40 in my workouts. Isn't that, 20 more pushups than I could usually do? Doesn't that affect my ability to get stronger?
Possibly. You also talk about deep sea divers. So this technique, deep sea divers actually don't like doing this, even though it allows them to hold their breath longer. They don't do this. We had James Nestor on the podcast a while ago.
Oh, he's awesome, by the way. Yeah, I love him.
This is like something you don't want to do, because this can actually kill you if you're trying to hold your breath underwater.
Yes. Big caution to anyone listening to this. It would seem that free diving and the Wim Hof method would just, go together like peas and carrots. Because, you're able to blow off CO2, you're able to hold your breath longer. And therefore, if you were going to dive 300 feet underwater, that's a useful ability. The issue is what they call shallow water blackouts, is because you're tricking your body by blowing off CO2, you don't always know when that gasp reflex is just going to kick in. And you can, and I have passed out doing this pushup method. When I did 80 pushups, I mentioned earlier, I hit 80 and boom, I just went out like a light, banged my head on the floor. And that was unfortunate. But if I was doing that and free diving, I would have passed out and my autonomic reflex would be to gasp. And this is why, 300 free divers have died in the last few years, is that because if you are doing this on dry land, the worst thing that's going to happen is you're going to fall down. You do it underwater, you're going to drown.
The Strenuous Life is an online platform that we created to help you turn your intentions into actions. We've done that in a few ways. We created a series of 50 different badges based around 50 different skills. There's hard skills like self-defense, wilderness survival, outdoor skills, soft skills like public speaking, social skills, personal finance, how to be a better husband, better father. We also provide accountability for you for your physical activity every day, doing a good deed so you're starting to think outside of yourself and thinking about something bigger. And then we also provide weekly challenges. They're going to put you outside of your comfort zone physically, intellectually, socially, and besides the weekly challenges and the daily check-ins and the badges, TSL platform also provides a way for you to get together with other TSL members in your area so you can meet up in actual physical space and start doing stuff together. And the guys, the meetups it's a ground up thing. They're organizing it themselves. Some events are really simple, just to get together for a ruck for an hour. But then other groups are planning these multi-day events where they're doing all sorts of stuff, camping outside and working on TSL stuff together. So it's a real community that's been formed here. If you'd like to get in our next enrollment, head over to strenuouslife.co. You can see everything that's involved with the Strenuous Life, and then make sure you get your email on our waiting list. That will help you be the first one to know when enrollment opens up. Strenuouslife.co, check it out and make sure to get your email on our waiting list. And I hope to see you in one of our next enrollments for the Strenuous Life. Right. And so I'm imagining this breathing technique also is what allows Wim, and which allowed yourself, we'll talk about in more detail later on, but to climb Mount Kilimanjaro at a record pace, right? You're able to, like, instead of doing the usual acclimation, doing slowly, you're able to get up in 2 days.
Yes. Faster than 2 days. We actually summited Kilimanjaro in 28 hours. I will say that is not the record. The record is just shy of 7 hours by this just crazy endurance athlete, Killian Jornet. But what he did is he actually acclimated his body at high altitude first, ran down to the bottom of the mountain. So when you're at high altitude, you're generating more red blood cells, right? So you can move more oxygen through your system. He went down to the bottom and then sprinted up to the top. And I got nothing on Killian, right? I would never assume that. However, what we did is we did it without acclimation. So we went up from the base of Kilimanjaro to the top, and then we did it in 28 hours. And it usually takes 5 days to acclimate your body to that altitude. And we had spoken to the U.S. militaries and sort of environmental scientists, they predicted that 70% of our group, of, I think we had about 28 people, would come down with acute mountain sickness or AMS, which is a debilitating and possibly fatal condition of being at high altitude. And, you know, when we did it, we only had two people come down with AMS, which is, you know, was unheard of. You know, we talked to some mountaineers in Holland. The Mountaineering Club of Holland said that all of us would die on the mountain. But, you know, we hiked up right to the top, and we did it at just this mind-boggling pace. And I did it mostly shirtless too.
I guess it was thanks to the breathing technique.
Right. So what we were doing is the entire way up, we were doing that Wim Hof breathing. So 28 hours of just, which took more mental focus than I knew I had to do. But we were breathing rapidly because we were trying to consciously account for the decreased oxygen by increasing our respiration. And it worked. And this is a technique that that people can use as they go up mountains now. Like you could, if you're getting down to acute mountain sickness, this is one way that I think that we can combat that, which is fantastic. You don't need Diamox. You don't need to, if you're getting AMS, you know, by all means descend quickly, because that's the medically right thing to do, but you can prevent it and this from even coming on with this breathing method. And that is really cool.
So let's circle back to the cold exposure. I'm a big fan of cold showers. We've written about it on the site before. A lot of our listeners are probably practitioners of cold showers. So what's the science behind cold exposure? I mean, what happens to our bodies when we expose ourselves to cold?
So the cold does a whole bunch of things to our autonomic nervous system that we just don't usually have. And the most obvious and the most interesting, I feel, is something called vasoconstriction. So our body is full of all these arteries and veins, and we've got enough of this to go, if you lined all those arteries and veins end to end, we'd be going across the states two times. It's a huge circulatory network. And along all of the veins, and veins are what return blood to the heart, are muscles. And these muscles just sit there, but they're potentially so strong that if I were to, you know, if someone were to cut my leg off below the knee, those veins would constrict to stop the flow of blood out of my body. And this is why soldiers are able to survive these debilitating wounds. We have this autonomic system that will stem blood loss. But the other use for it, and the more common use for vasoconstriction, is to shunt blood to the core if you get cold, to sacrifice the extremities to keep your core warm. Now, for the vast majority of us who live at this sort of constant 72 degrees, we never ever activate those muscles. So those muscles get weak, and that weakness leads to all sorts of circulatory diseases. So just getting into the snow, getting into cold water is like lifting weights for your circulatory system. And it's the easiest thing to do, to turn a cold shower, and then they flex, and you go warm, and they relax, and you go cold, and they flex again. And, you know, even somebody with chiseled abs who's a total gym rat could have this like totally weak a circulatory system. So that's the first thing that the cold does. Another thing that it does is it modulates insulin production, which is, you know, helps with insulin resistance is the condition that leads to diabetes. The cold will also make you lose weight so fast. I mean, if you think about, you know, you're at the gym and you have like a little bit of a paunch and you want to lose weight, it's pretty hard to do that through running and exercise, right? I mean, you can, but it takes a lot of focus effort. Your body would generally prefer to burn muscle and other tissues before it goes after your fat content. And the reason for that is that fat has an evolutionary purpose to actually heat your body. And we have a tissue that we're born with called brown adipose tissue or brown fat that every human infant who's not premature has. And that's because when you're that small, you're just born, you don't have the musculature or digestive system to heat your body the normal way, you know, that adults do. And, you know, every time you move, you generate heat. Every time your digestive system sort of moves, it generates heat. And this is how we maintain it, sort of a 98.6 body temperature. That's how we thermoregulate. But infants, who are also very small, which means they have a high surface area to mass ratio, lose heat very quickly. So the strategy that infants use to survive is this brown adipose tissue, which they have a lot of. And what it does is it sucks white fat from their body and directly metabolizes it for heat energy. And it produces a lot of heat. And this is how all of us got through our earliest years. Now, as we get older, we're able to heat ourselves in various other ways. And scientists thought that most adults just didn't have any BAT until 2007, when and I won't get into the whole story and how they found it, but a researcher named Aaron Sipes over at Harvard discovered that adults actually do have it. And the reason that they didn't realize it before is because you only keep it around after childhood, and you only develop more if you're constantly exposed to cold. And the response and the reason why you get BAT is that you're cold and your body's like, okay, I don't want to shiver myself warm all the time. I'm going to use my metabolism. And that sucks out and then suck out your white fat. So this white fat is energy that we have, but it's not for caloric energy to move our muscles. It's caloric energy to heat our bodies. And that's one of the things that's sort of an evolutionary mismatch with the way we live today.
And you actually lost 7 pounds of fat after your first trip to Poland with Wim, correct?
Yeah, isn't that nuts, right? Me hanging out in the snow, eating Polish food, which I will remind you is mostly sausage and, you know, sausage and pierogies. So oily, fatty, carby food. I lost 7 pounds of fat while hanging out with
them. So let's say someone's listening to this, like, that sounds awesome. Like, I want to give my circulatory system a workout, but I also want to get this brown fat so I can start losing white fat. So like, what do you need to do? Like, how long do you need to expose yourself to cold for you to start developing this ability?
Well, everyone's physiology is a little bit different, so I can't give an exact response. And actually, still research is ongoing. But I can say that I was able to keep my body warm through this metabolic process very well after 3 days of going out in the snow for as long as I could manage it. You know, and I need to be clear that you need to be in control in the snow. If you start shivering uncontrollably or start getting frostbite, you're doing this wrong. You're pushing past your limits. Humans are designed, we evolved to adapt rapidly. Our ancestors who passed on their genes didn't see an oncoming snowstorm and say, I'll get ready for it next month. They were like, our bodies have to be ready now. And so you build it up extremely rapidly. One test in a lab in Holland showed that they put like 12 diabetic men, so overweight diabetic men, I think they were mostly in their 50s, and they put them in a cold room for about 51 degrees for 3 hours a day for 3 weeks. At the end of that time, and they were just wearing shorts and a shirt, I believe. At the end of that time, just being cold decreased their insulin sensitivity by 54%, which is a dramatic improvement for their diabetes. So you do this quick, and all you need to do is get cold. You know, start with cold showers. That's the easiest, you know, way to do it. You start with your hot shower. You take your Scottish shower that starts hot and goes cold. And then when you're in that environment, the most important thing is to relax. Like, you don't want to warm yourself by that muscle action, which may help you lose weight, but it's not going to help you get this metabolic activity. So you consciously just, you know, you take a deep breath and you just say, okay, I'm cold, and it'll be all right. And this is the signal to your nervous system to start building up metabolic changes in your body. Another very easy way to do things, something that I do a lot, is to, if it's winter, which it is now, go for a run outside in just a pair of shorts. Maybe wear a hat and gloves if it's super cold out and you're worried about your extremities, but go shirtless. Or if you're a woman, you know, wear a sports bra, but to go with as as much of your skin as possible out to the cold, and then go for a 3 mile run or a 5 mile run or something like that. Come back, and what's going to happen is that because you're moving your muscles a lot, you're actually generating a tremendous amount of heat. You know, if you run in the winter now and you're wearing fleece, you're probably sweating under all that stuff. So this is a great way to do this method because your skin is actually getting that signal for the cold. Your skin will be cold to the touch, but your core will be warm. But those neural signals for saying get ready for winter are coming into your body, and that's going to be one great way to start building up this metabolic change.
So for the cold showers, is there like a time length you should shoot for, like 5 minutes under the cold, or does it matter?
Longer equals better in this case, but you get the, with any sort of new practice, you have the benefit of the law of diminishing returns, right? Where, and this happens really for any exercise routine, any meditation routine, anything new that you do is you learn the most in the first, the introduction to this. And if you can get into the shower and relax and stay there for like 30 seconds of just being after you're relaxed, you will have gotten a huge benefit into your system. Now, if you stay there longer, you'll still get benefits, but the curve sort of bends a little bit after that. So I would say, minimum shoot for a minute, right? Because that's not really, it's not going to kill you. It's going to be fine. If you can do five, that's great. Some people work this up for a long, long time, but the goal is to subdue your panic response and relax. And that is a signal to your body that you're getting, that you have to have mental control instead of this autonomic control. And that's the first step. And then you do more stuff and you'll find that it gets easier. And the really cool thing is that, so when you're in the cold, you release all these awesome feel good hormones, norepinephrine, epinephrine, adrenaline, cortisol, they're all start releasing in your system, and you get out of that cold shower and you feel awesome. And that becomes sort of this addictive and really fun thing.
And besides the cold exposure, I mean, that's what your book's primarily about. But are there any other ways we can inject stress in our lives to become stronger?
Sure. I mean, I find the cold to be this a safe way to do it, right? Because, you obviously can get, kill yourself doing with extreme cold, right? But it's easier to warm up your body if you get a little too cold than it is to cool down your body if you get a little too hot. But that doesn't mean you can't do the same basic training with the other extreme, right? You just have to be a lot more careful in pushing your limits. But yeah, I mean, the breathing method, the cold, you can use heat, you can use altitude. I mean, a lot of this stuff is things that people have known for a while, right? The reason why the Olympic Training Center in America is up in Colorado is because we're at 5,000 feet. And that's an environmental stimulus you don't even realize about, but you just get the passive benefit of being at high altitude. So, and I write in the book, there's this concept that I have called the wedge, which is where any environmental stimulus that comes into your body that has a predictable biological response, if that stimulus and that response, if you have any control over that response, that is a moment of where you can train. And I talk about this in the book, is that you can say a sneeze is a great example of this. If you start to have to sneeze and you say, well, I don't want to sneeze right now, you can actually delay that. You can say, okay, I'm just going to resist this sneezing reflex that I have. That is growing this ability you have to sort of master your autonomic nervous system. Now, I don't know if you should never sneeze in your life. I mean, this is not necessarily useful. Sneezing is a great thing to do, but it's one of the fundamental ways that humans learn. And you could maybe learn to hold your pee for a long time or delay an orgasm. And there's just lots of like predictable biological responses that you can start to master. And, the body is the limit there, whatever you can think of.
So part of your experiment with Wim Hof's method was you did besides the hike up Mount Kilimanjaro, you also did the Tough Guy. Mm-hmm. And we've had Scott Keneally on the podcast talk about the Sufferfest and the Tough Guy.
He's running that right now. I am so jealous.
Is he doing that right now? Cold. I mean, it's cold here in Oklahoma. I can't imagine what it is over there. But it's this brutal obstacle course. It's like the original obstacle course race. Just it's in the dead of winter in England. This guy named Mouse makes his guys go through just ice cold water, just brutal stuff. And you did this, tough guy. And not only did you do it, you did it without, you just did it in a pair of shorts and a pair of shoes. That's it. So can you tell us about your experience doing the tough guy while following Wim Hof's method?
Yeah. You know, I am not an endurance athlete. Like, I didn't expect to want to win this or anything. And you know, people win tough guy at in like an hour and a half, but it's a, what is it, like a 12 or 15 mile race. But mostly obstacles where you're jumping over walls and then into like icy water, and then you're all muddy, and then you're climbing under barbed wire, and there's electrical shocks and all of these sort of like, you know, typical, what we now think of as typical obstacle course things. But the main obstacle in Tough Guy is the cold. And people will go run this basically wearing wetsuits, you know, covered in neoprene. Because, you know, the year before I did it, we had, there were 300 people who ended up in the emergency room with hypothermia. Now, I wanted to run this in just shorts. You know, I had shorts, shoes. I may have had gloves because I wanted to be able to climb up those obstacles efficiently. And I completed the course in about 3.5 hours, which is, you know, definitely nothing special, but in this frigid weather. And I was just warm. I was actually elated the whole time I was doing it. It was just this total high, because whereas everyone else was shivering and sort of, you know, really fighting this one challenge, my body responded to it with just releasing adrenaline and epinephrine and just making me feel great. And everyone who I met on the course was like, "Why are you smiling, my friend?" And I was like, it was just an awesome sort of just whole body pleasurable experience to me. And I think because I'd been doing this Wim Hof training for at that point regularly for about 6 months, the challenge that other people's bodies were sort of failing at, I had just no issue with. I thought it was great.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, like this whole obstacle course racing phenomenon, like this interest in Wim Hof and what he's doing. It seems like there is an underground revolt going against sort of the diseases of civilization. I mean, are there any other, you know, little subcultures you came across during the research of your book where you found people, you know, purposely injecting environmental stress in their life to become healthier and stronger?
Sure. I mean, you know, I like the obstacle course race industry because it's so contained and obvious, right? It's like, you know, you're a weekend warrior and you go out there and you get a little suffering because, hey, not only does it look good on Facebook, it actually feels really cool to take on a challenge, to do something out of your ordinary routine. And, you know, in some sense, every exercise routine that anyone takes on, you know, CrossFit or surfing, where you hang out in the water for a hell of a long period of time, all of that is sort of bucking your nose at this sort of comfortable life that you really, you know, you could just live in your office the whole time, every day. And, you know, I have just mad respect for anyone who can go out there and just go grab a little bit of suffering and say, actually, that suffering is actually making me stronger. And then I start to enjoy it. But, you know, maybe you've seen this viral video going around of like kids in Siberia dumping ice water on themselves. This is where there's this school where they have it's like an elementary or maybe even a preschool. And they have this video of like these kids running outside into the Siberian winter, pouring ice water on themselves, rolling in the snow for 5 minutes, and then going back inside. And the teachers at the school say that it has prevented all of their kids from getting sick, which is crazy. You know, no one would do that in America. We are so coddled in this country. You know, this is the country where a free range child ends up having the parents of that kid end up having Child Protective Services called on them. It's just so funny. But I think there's a lot of people out there who want to get back to nature. And you know, there's a whole ancestral health movement, barefoot running, you know, paleo diet people. I mean, all of these people are pushing on this idea that technology isn't all that it cracked up to be, and that maybe comfort hides its own type of suffering.
So before you started Wim Hof's method for a year, you got your physiology test. You went through some medical tests. Mm-hmm. How did your physiology change after a year of following his methodology?
Well, so I went to the Boulder Sports and Recreation Center over at University of Colorado Boulder, where this physiologist first measured me before I was doing the method regularly. So I had actually consciously stopped doing it for about a month in the middle of the summer. And he measured me on a stress test, which is basically getting me up to my VO2 max and seeing how my body processed energy. And I was a pretty ordinary dude, like, you know, definitely nothing special. He actually sort of laughed at how not special I was, which meant that I burned mostly carbohydrates during my exercise, and then eventually started burning fat at the very end, which is the exact opposite of what you want to be if you're an endurance athlete. And at the end of this, of the training course, after I'd climbed Kili, after I'd done all these things, where I hadn't changed my daily workout routine any more than doing the breathing exercises and cold exposure, at the end of all of that, and that's like 15 minutes a day, it's really not that much time, he examined my physiology again, and I had suddenly switched to a primarily fat burning person, and I was able to do additional stages on his VO2 max test, and he was actually really surprised by these results, because I hadn't actually changed my cardio routine that much. I was doing like three runs a week or something like that. And he was like, it was as if I had added 7 hours of exercise to my routine every week. And he thought it was really, really cool. And I was pretty happy with those results.
So you went into this investigation as a skeptic. I mean, are you a believer now, or are there some aspects of Wim's claims you're like, I don't know about that, but are there some aspects where you're like, yeah, that's I'm down with that?
Oh, I mean, certainly I'm always going to be a skeptic of claims that are too big. And I think Wim is the doorway into something really beautiful and really wonderful about our physiology, but sometimes he'll say things that are impossible to prove or dangerous to prove. I mean, he'll sometimes say it can cure cancer or cure AIDS, and I don't know about that. Like I'll wait for the evidence to roll in for that. But what I will say is that he has certainly opened my eyes to a different way of looking at our body in the environment. Like, we used to think that health, like general health, relied on two things: diet and exercise. You know, the energy you put into your body and what you expended through physical exertion. But what this has taught me is that there's actually a third pillar, and that the environment you inhabit is just as important as those two other things. And that alone seems to have just a whole cascade of other effects on health in general. And it's changed my life, and it's changed my perspective on things. Forever, I would think.
Well, Scott, this has been a great conversation. Where can people learn more about your book and your work?
So I have the book, which is called What Doesn't Kill Us: How Freezing Water, Extreme Altitude, and Environmental Conditioning Will Renew Our Lost Evolutionary Strength. It is on all the places that you might find a book, bookstores and Amazon and all those places. There's an audiobook out. So if you really liked listening to my voice now, you can do 10 hours of it, on Audible and iBooks. And also, I have Facebook, I got the Twitter, I've got email, I've got my own website, which is scottcarney.com. All the things that, Google is your friend for finding me.
Well, Scott Carney, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Awesome. This has been a lot of fun. Thanks.
My guest today was Scott Carney. He's the author of the book, What Doesn't Kill Us. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can also find out more information about Scott's work at scottcarney.com. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/coldexposure, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. This show is recorded on clearcast.io. If you're a podcaster who are looking for a solution for better sounding remote podcast interviews, check it out, clearcast.io, something I've developed. As always, we appreciate your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.